This edition of the Arts Review was first broadcast on the 2nd of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Today, the editor of the omnivore literary website Fleur MacDonald is in the studio with me to talk books. We'll be leafing through the pages of Peter Ackroyd's take on the life of Alfred Hitchcock, reading A History of the Public School by David Turner, and Kate Hamer's new novel, The Girl in the Red Coat, will be under discussion as well. That's all coming up here on the Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, Fleur. Great to have you with us as ever. Let's start off by talking about Peter Ackroyd's latest release, Alfred Hitchcock, a biography that delves into the mind of the great film director, responsible, of course, for such classics as Psycho, The Birds, Vertigo, the names are well known. Always interesting, isn't it, when a titan of biography, whether it's of cities or people, tackles a really well-known person like Hitchcock.
Yes, and I was extremely excited by it, but I have to say, completely disappointed having read it. I came out of having read it, I just couldn't quite understand why Ackroyd had chosen Hitchcock. There didn't seem to be any personal enthusiasm or any personal take on his work, which was a pity. I mean, Hitchcock is such a great subject matter, and there have been a lot of great things written about him before, and it just didn't really seem to add to that sum total.
I wonder, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, Ackroyd's a pretty prolific writer, a generator of copy from all sorts of different sort of disciplines, and Hitchcock too was a prolific filmmaker. I mean, is that perhaps maybe one of the things that makes them slightly kindred spirits, just the sheer, you know, prodigious output they both enjoyed? Or is that maybe not enough to still hold it together?
I mean, that is true. Hitchcock started working on a film even before he'd finished the one before. And there are other similarities. Ackroyd, his last novel was on the East End, and Hitchcock grew up in Leytonstone. And you sort of wish that he would bring to life Hitchcock's childhood, but instead we just get the same tired anecdote about when he was a small boy, his father sent him to the police station with a note, and then he got locked up, and that's meant to apparently explain his fascination and his fear of the law. And Ackroyd recounts it, and then he doesn't really say any more, which is a pity.
It's interesting because obviously we've seen other, you know, lives of Hitchcock, other profiles, and he does seem that someone is quite, it sort of divides opinion as to what he is. You know, people say, oh, he's one of the great auteurs, to use a phrase I always find rather unhelpful, whether he's an artist, a visionary. Does Ackroyd sort of come to a conclusion on that front? Does he sort of classify how he sees Hitchcock at all, even?
I think he comes to the conclusion, but it's the same conclusion as François Truffaut in his book of interviews. And it is littered with quotes from Truffaut. And I would say, why don't you read that book of interviews instead? Why don't you read Peter Conrad has actually wrote a book of essays about Hitchcock, and it's more about his personal take on all the films. But for that reason, it's far better than reading what is essentially a long Wikipedia article. And I would say, if you don't feel like buying the book, you can just read Ackroyd's article on the Daily Mail. I shouldn't say that. But he kind of summarises all of the salacious gossip, which is sort of what we all want to know. So he talks about Grace Kelly. He talks about how she told filthy jokes and was a volcano covered in snow. And that's all in the article on the Daily Mail. Don't bother buying the book.
It's interesting about Ackroyd. You know, we mentioned this idea of him writing these other biographies, sort of, you know, biographies of the city and this sort of thing. Do you think that it presents a particular challenge, you know, even to a very skilled, you know, weaver of biographical writing, to capture then someone who's simply too well known? Is that almost the problem, that people do come with those preconceived notions? You mentioned the Truffaut sort of profiles. People maybe feel like there's nothing left to tell.
Well, I mean, you could say that, and I would say that that's being charitable. For example, I think it came out early this year at the BFI, there was the Holocaust documentary that was filmed by, well, it was cut by Hitchcock. And Aykroyd doesn't mention it at all, even though it's an absolutely fascinating story, which tells us a lot about the director. It's footage taken from 11 concentration camps. And one of the long tracking shots, typically Hitchcock, is of a Lutheran priest, a Catholic priest, an Anglican clergyman and a rabbi coming into one of the camps. And you basically see the horrific sights as if it were through their eyes, which is very Hitchcockian. And Aykroyd doesn't mention it at all.
I guess just sort of finally on this, what do you think it should prompt Aykroyd to, I don't know, return to other disciplines? We mentioned how he's probably already got, you know, a number of other projects on the go. What would be the Fleur MacDonald advice then? Stick to you know, cities, those sort of profiles. Avoid the big names of Hollywood, perhaps.
I wouldn't really presume to speak for
why not?
Peter
Aykroyd. Why not give him some pointers? I think
if I'm going to give him some advice, I would say stick to writing Daily Mail articles.
Okay, so that is Alfred Hitchcock by Peter Aykroyd, which is out now, Chatto, published by Chatto and Windus. Let's move on, Fleur, next, and talk a little bit about, well, this is really interesting. This is David Turner's book, The Old Boys, The Decline and Rise of the Public School. And I guess I should help some of our international listeners that obviously public school in this country, we mean sort of private school by, say, US standards, for example.
Yes,
and that's unhelpfully confusing.
It's confusing, as Turner, he's an expert, explains, because private schools aren't public schools. Private schools are small schools that are often run just by one person and aren't big institutions like Eton or Winchester or all of the others. But yes.
So it's just important to...
They basically, I think the definition would be to have more fee payers than people there, you know, on bursaries or there for free.
And tell us about this, because it is interesting. I mean, particularly, I don't know, for example, it's, you know, election season here in the UK, and there's always so much talk about, you know, the background, the provenance, if you will, of our political characters. And it does seem something that seems to inspire such a, you know, divisive points of view. What kind of a job does Turner do in terms of unpicking all of those complex sort of things that are woven together?
Turner is the former education correspondent for the FT, and he tells us at the beginning that he went to public school, so we sort of know where he stands. The two questions he raises are actually quite unexpected and absolutely fascinating. So his first question is, why did public schools decline in the 18th century? Because if you think about Tom Brown's school days, the descriptions of what happened at public school were horrific. So why did they decline in the 18th century and why did they improve? And then the second question is, are public schools an asset to our nation? So he doesn't really, he tackles it from a slightly different perspective. And that makes the book far more interesting. And it means that people with a broad interest in education will be able to read it, not those with a public school fetish.
Well, this I was going to ask you about, because as you said, he's a former education correspondent. So he obviously has that more, I don't know, so I guess a more sort of academic perspective. But he's not afraid, presumably, to, you know, come out one way or the other in terms of that verdict you talk about. What that idea of the net contribution, I suppose, if you like, to society. I guess I don't want to, you know, give a spoiler away of what side of the fence he comes down on, but how does he sort of frame that
well,
argument?
He actually frames it in an interesting way. So in the 18th century, he talks about what was wrong with public schools. And in fact, those are many of the same problems that affect state schools today. So the three sort of big problems, and that's were in public schools in the 18th century, were riots. So there were riots over beer prices at Winchester. The Riot Act had to be read at rugby, and the boys had to be quelled by farmers with horsewhips. All very dramatic. So discipline is a problem. The other problem is classroom sizes. So in the early 1800s at Eton, one teacher had to look after 190 boys. And at St Paul's, one teacher would teach one class and then leave the others to do their homework and then swap and teach the other class. So unwieldy classroom sizes, problem for state schools today. And the third one would probably be a limited curriculum. So public schools, all they seemed to learn was Greek and Latin. So when Alan Turing's parents came to the headmaster, this is one of the anecdotes David Turner tells. When they came to the headmaster at Sherborne to complain about the lack of science, he said, well, if he wants to learn about science, he shouldn't be at public school. And for example, at Ampleforth, they used to teach ornithology. So completely and utterly bizarre. And David Turner kind of, he draws a comparison with state schools today by saying that in order to climb up league tables, state schools are going for easier subjects, which aren't necessarily recognised by universities. So, for example, media studies, that dreaded word. So he really kind of frames the question in a way that it sheds a light on other education, other sectors. Mm. And as to whether public schools are an asset, I would have to say that perhaps his argument is slightly expected and also a bit of a cop-out. He basically says it's better to have them than not to have them.
And what about, I mean, I mentioned sort of the current political class, if you will, and this is this constant refrain that, you know, perhaps, you know, members of the, you know, the Westminster sort of inner circle, if you like, are out of touch. They're necessarily out of touch because they all came through this system. I mean, does he sort of address that notion that this is an institution in broad terms that is necessarily divisive?
He does address it, but then he typically says something that takes you off guard. He talks about the foundation of the welfare state and the three people in charge of that, Beveridge, Attlee and Will Butler later, they're all public school boys. So you can't really divide people up in that way. And I would say that, you know, and this is the challenging aspect of the book, is that he talks about the state school not actually competing enough with public schools. So if they were selective, if they did harder subjects, then maybe people do, parents prefer to send their children to a free institution at the end of the day. So it's just because there isn't the competition.
Pretty fascinating stuff. And I think, yeah, interesting sort of window into, history, looking back through these eras you've described and right up to the present day, certainly here in the UK. That's The Old Boys, The Decline and Rise of the Public School by David Turner, which is out now, published by Yale University Press. Interesting. We've had Hitchcock. We've talked public schools, light and shade. Let's talk a little fiction, perhaps, Fleur, before the end of the programme. The Girl in the Red Coat, Kate Hamer's debut novel about a kidnapped 8-year-old girl. Now, instantly, that gets me sort of thinking, oh, this is going to be an incredibly sort of stressful, challenging read. You know, there's enough bad stories in the world without my escapism also being affected by a story of some poor lost youth. But what's the sort of the idea here? Is it kind of classic thriller territory? Is it slightly more thoughtful?
It's both. I have to say, like you, when I kind of read the blurb, I was disposed to dislike it. There are far too many books about cults or religions that beg a belief. I mean, you just have to think about Grace MacLean's The Land of Decoration or Anouk Markovitz's novel about two Hasidic sisters. We've been there before. So that was the first reason why I didn't think I was going to like it. And the second reason was that it seems a bit as if it's just been put through the publishing machine. So the author is a graduate of the Curtis Brown Creative Writing Course. And on their website, they proudly proclaim how many of their graduates have been published. I mean, big surprise, they're agents, that's their job. And Faber spent tons of money hiring women in red coats to hand out excerpts. I think it was 20,000 excerpts at tube stations. It just seems
so where a bit of aggressive marketing almost drifts into gimmickry, perhaps,
exactly,
one would say.
Exactly. It just seems a bit obvious. And, you know, if you think about literary thriller about a cult, they're just targeting the mum's net demographic. But it was quite good.
So it's like reluctantly concede.
Yes.
It was actually rather good. And what, in a sort of, you know, you just need to sort of churn through and keep turning the pages kind of way, or does it actually deliver something, I don't know, a little more thoughtful, perhaps?
Well, it's quite an interesting structure. So the 8-year-old girl gets kidnapped, and her story is interweaved with the story of her mother. Immediately, that throws up the problem that you're always going to be more excited by the 8-year-old girl, because she's either going to be forced to drink Kool-Aid or join in with some horrific religious orgies. Rather, you're going to be interested in her story rather than the maudlin mother. But Hamer balances the two stories well, and they echo each other, and she keeps the pace quick. One of the ways she does it is that characters never really turn out how you expect. And so she's quite good at keeping the reader on their toes in that way.
I guess just before we wrap up, Flo, let me ask you. I mean, you sort of alluded to this by discussing the sort of sausage machine production line nature of some of this production, particularly in this area of sort of quick fix fiction. I mean, how profound a problem is that? Or do you think it's unfair to sort of say this is an industry-wide issue, because there's lots of great new fiction that's being published all the time, or is that something that you feel certainly some of the big publishing houses need to be a little more alive to, and they need to be perhaps a bit more creative with their thinking when it comes to sort of churning out these ideas for these things that are going to be big selling works?
I mean, I think it's a bit unfair to call The Girl in the Red Coat quick fix fiction. It's better than that. I just think that people, you've got to trust in the readers, and I think the readers are eventually going to tire of those kind of literary thrillers.
Mm. Okay. Well, that's a fair, I think that's a very sort of reasoned outcome. That's The Girl in the Red Coat. You can judge it for yourself. It's by Kate Hamer, and it's published by Faber and Faber, and it's out now. Flo MacDonald, editor of The Omnivore, thank you very much for being with us on the programme. This has been the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Thanks too to my producer, Holly Fisher, and the show's researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. Gillian DeBias will be joined by Karen Krasanovich, and they'll be talking movies. For the time being, though, thanks for listening.